There were 13 colonies that went into the Revolutionary War. Those 13 colonies united themselves by what was called a Continental Congress, and certain acts that were incorporated there on behalf of all of the colonies. And they were unified in their struggle against Great Britain and in their struggle against the war, the English rule, English dominion of the colonies. However, when that war ended, there was a great struggle as to what are we now? We're free. There was no central government. There was no centralized documents. There was nothing other than the Continental Congress. The Articles of Confederation had been adopted during the Revolutionary War, which basically made the American colonies Confederate. And that doesn't mean Southerner or anything like that. The word Confederate means simply that they had compiled their resources and yet maintained their sovereignty. In other words, Massachusetts had no rule over what was done in Georgia. Georgia had no rule over what was done in North Carolina. North Carolina didn't even have a say in what was done in South Carolina. They remained sovereign entities. They could govern their own affairs. And only to the extent that the Articles of Confederation established them as a unified confederacy were they able to interact with one another. Part of the problem that was that occurred after the close of the Revolutionary War was the fact that there was no regulation on international commerce. There was no regulation on interstate commerce, which meant that Well, to be honest with you, a lot of things transpired because of that. England and some of the other nations, although England had lost the war, literally, they didn't feel like they had lost the war. They just decided to quit fighting. And they still had soldiers and forts in America that had refused to leave and would not leave. They maintained their fortresses here to some extent. And they decided basically to sit back and try another tactic. And that tactic was to bankrupt the individual colonies that existed. And you do that by selectively trading with different colonies and pitting one colony against another. For instance, if where were all of the colonies accustomed to acquiring all of their supplies? They were all coming from England. Very little of the commerce was generated inside the colonies itself. Remember all of the laws that had been passed. We talked about the Stamp Act and the Tea Act and all of those legislations that had come from England that had restricted the colonists from manufacturing their own goods. We even talked about the Hat Act, which stated that a colonist in the colonies, they weren't even allowed to make their own hats. They had to order them from England. And England had done that not unfairly. You see, England owned the colonies, and they just had established the fact that they wanted to be involved in the money-making process. And so they demanded that all the goods had to come from England. Consequently, the colonists had grown accustomed to getting their materials from England. And now that the war was over, where are you going to get your materials? Well, you're going to keep going to England until something better comes along. Although trade did open with France and some of the other nations of Europe, they all seem to have the same idea, which was, if we play our cards right, we can go in here and take this thing over. These little colonies really did not propose, the colonies never really posed a threat to Europe or to England at all in the war. It was not a thing where England was afraid if they lost the war, we were going to invade England. They never worried about that. Europe was never worried that the American colonists were going to launch their navies and come over and invade Europe. That was never a worry. And so when England quit fighting, really, to be honest with you, they just got tired of fighting and said, hey, we're going to back off for a while. We'll try another way. And so they began to deal with the trade. And the way you do that is you sell commodities to New York at one price, and you sell those same commodities to Connecticut at another price. And before long, Connecticut and New York are angry with one another, and they're fighting about the situation. Or you refuse to sell to certain colonies, and you sell to other colonies. And knowing the human spirit and the depravity of man, if all at once, if Brother Folk is a colony and Brother King is a colony and Brother Dan is a colony over here, and all at once I want to get them fighting with one another rather than unified, I start dealing with Brother Folk. And I say, now look, I'm going to sell you all of the cotton you want, but I'm not going to sell to these guys, so you can sell to them. Well, knowing Brother Rex like I do, and he wants to make a profit, he's going to start doing what? He's going to take what I sell him, jack the price up, and he's going to sell it to Brother Brad. And when him and Dan have an out, he's going to raise the price for Brother Dan and lower it for Brother Brad. And I'm just sitting back watching, see. And that's basically what England is doing. England is sitting back watching while these little fires are ignited in hopes that these colonies will go to war with themselves. And when that was done, all England looked forward to doing was just coming in, picking up the pieces, reestablishing its rule as it had, and things go on like they hadn't for years. They did that economically. There was no regulation on interstate commerce, and that's what gave them another advantage, and that was this. There was nothing to say that Rex couldn't charge Brad $50 for a bale of cotton and charge Dan $20 for a bale of cotton. I mean, he didn't have to be fair. He could do what he wanted to with his. Anything that belonged to him, he could do with it. There was no regulation of interstate commerce. There was no principle of fairness established. And so squabbles did begin to arise between the colonies. They began to get angry with one another. They began to get frustrated and fight. And there were wars that took place. As a matter of fact, some of the Indian tribes were allowed to scalp other colonists in some of the colonies up around New York and areas like that. I think it was the Wyoming Valley Indians up in that area. I don't know exactly where they were. They were encouraged to scalp any intruders, quote unquote, that came into the new colony. And those were other colonists. So there are some pretty terrible things going on up in the colonies as they fought. England's sitting back watching. France is sitting back watching to see what is going to happen. And the men who had been leaders, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, the men who had signed the Declaration of Independence, they began to realize that if something is not done, all that we fought for in the Revolutionary War is in vain. It's all going to falter. It's all going to fail if we don't do something to unify this. Several of the squabbles had been settled. One of them at Mount Vernon. Washington had invited a couple of the states that had an ongoing argument. He had invited them there to Mount Vernon, to his plantation, and they had settled their differences right there. Having done that, Washington realized what we need to do is get together and talk as colonies and or as states at this point and decide what we want to do. They called for the Annapolis convention, and they were to meet at Annapolis, Maryland. And while several of the states showed up, not enough of them to make any lasting impact, so they decided to try again the next year in Philadelphia. And that's what brings you to the Continental Congress at Philadelphia. We've talked about the Constitution. We'll not go through all that this morning, other than to say that it was titled appropriately, I think, A Bundle of Compromises. And that's not to point it out as a weak document. That is the only document that has existed in the history of the world unchanged for as long as it has. That document has governed our country for over 200 years now without any significant changes to it. And that is an amazing document. It's an amazing piece of work. I think it was Chamberlain, who was the Prime Minister of England, said within this century, he said that it is the greatest achievement that the mind of man has ever come up with. And so it is a remarkable document. We have incorporated to govern our affairs. However, there were things that took place and transpired that we began to talk about last week. We talked about as the Continental Congress convened, it convened basically illegally. They had stated they were going to do one thing, and yet they knew they were going to do something entirely different. What their stated purpose was, to get all the delegates there, was to amend the Articles of Confederation. That was what they had publicized. They were going to work on the Articles of Confederation. They were going to change those and make them fit a little more and try to smooth out some of the differences. And yet the leaders or the organizers of the Continental Congress knew when they assembled that their purpose was far more, or was more far-reaching than that. Their intent was to formulate a new document that would govern an organized or a unified system of states. And so as they met, began to consider those things, of course, Ben Franklin was there, George Washington was asked to come. And really not for any contribution that he would make. Washington was not as great a statesman as might be considered. Washington was a general. He was a military man. And Washington's expertise did not rest in his ability to put down great political ideology on paper. It existed in the ability to shoot people, you know, and Washington had learned those things. But what Washington had become was a figurehead to all of the colonies. He was the commander of the Continental Army. And because of that, he carried a great deal of respect. Now, he was not a buffoon. I don't want to give you that impression. He had some ideologies, and he obviously became the president of this country. Was a smart man, a man of great integrity. But he himself would not have been one that could have hammered out the Constitution of the United States. And as they met, they called Washington and asked Washington to come. And the idea was that he would preside over this meeting, and in so doing, he would give credence to what these individuals were trying to accomplish. So that when their document was finally released and went back to the states for a ratification, it would not be just something that a bunch of men got together and hammered out, but here's what the Continental Congress, presided over by General George Washington, has proposed for our nation. And so he gave some weight to the voice that the Continental Congress was to have. And as they met, we talked about Madison. And Madison was the individual who literally, if you wanted to ascribe a name, most people would not even think of Madison at all. But Madison was literally the father of the Constitution of the United States of America. He basically put it together. He was the one that pushed here and pulled there in order to get things to fall in line the way they should. And when all was said and done, he had done his job well because the Constitution was birthed by that group. It was his notes that gave us a recollection of what happened there. There was no notes. As a matter of fact, if you'd have seen what was going on and heard what was going on, you would have probably, if it were to happen in this day and time, the ATF and the FBI would have showed up and raided the place. You know, they probably would have burned it to the ground, killed everybody inside of it. Because these men got together, they stated one purpose, and yet when they arrived, they boarded up the windows of the place where they're going to meet. And they maintained strict secrecy. No one was allowed in. No one was allowed to know what was going on. And all that we knew is they were in there talking about the future of our nation. And you can imagine what our reaction would be today. Well, you can look back just several years ago when Hillary decided she wasn't going to let anybody know what was going on with her health care plan. And look at how Americans reacted. And you can imagine then what must have been in the minds of at least many of the colonists when they saw this thing transpire. The windows are all boarded up and these men go in and it's closed session and nobody can know what's going on. And so the idea perhaps of conspiracy or something even greater than that was in the minds of many of the colonists. And if it were not for Madison's notes, we wouldn't know anything that went on. The secrecy prevailed. I mean, most of them, even in their later writings, did not write detailed accounts of what happened. Washington would mention the fact and some of the things that had gone on there. Franklin would mention a few of the things that had gone on there. But for the most part, there isn't anything in depth about what happened here and then here and then here other than Madison's notes, which were published about 35 or 40 years later and gave us a look into what went on there. Ben Franklin, who attended the conference, was there, but Franklin was an old man by this time. And Franklin's political keenness was wavering. He was not a real key player in the establishment of the Constitution of the United States. What is interesting is that some others were not there. They did not come. And for instance, we've mentioned the fact that Thomas Jefferson did not attend the Continental Convention that put together the Constitution of the United States. He was in France. John Hancock was not there, who had signed so boldly his name to the Declaration of Independence. He was not there. And Patrick Henry was not there. So there were a number of individuals who had been key players in the establishment of the freedom of the colonies movement that didn't bother to show up. They had some opposing viewpoints, and we'll look at some of those in a little while. But when all was said and done, the Constitution of the United States was agreed upon by these delegates. Now, basically, that meant absolutely nothing. They had to carry this document back to their individual states, and the governing bodies of those states had to decide at that point what they were going to do about it. In order for the Constitution to become binding, the statement in the Constitution stated this, that 9 of the 13 colonies must ratify the document before it becomes binding upon those ratifying states. In other words, if your state did not ratify the Constitution, they were not going to impose themselves on you. But you merely would not be covered by the document, but the document would go into effect for all of those states that were in agreement. So it took 9 states to formulate America. And as time went on, we talked about the fact that states began to adopt it, but the key players as far as the states were concerned were the states of New York and Virginia, neither of which adopted the Constitution initially. There was a lot of controversy in those states, and the main part of the controversy was over what we call the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist positions. Now, the Federalist was the individual that basically had convened in Philadelphia for the proposal of the Constitution. The Constitution established a strong federal government. The Anti-Federalist, one of the most well-known, was Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry was opposed to a strong federal government. And we look at now what's gone on in America in the last 25 or 30 years, and we kind of have to rethink, you know, maybe we should have listened to some of what Patrick Henry had to say, because he could foresee the encroachment of a federal government upon the states. He could see the day when the federal government would become the huge monopoly that would basically become what the monarchy was in Europe. It would dictate policy to the states. And so Patrick Henry was an ardent opposer to the Constitution of the United States. And there were others. And what happened in New York and in Virginia in particular was the fact that because those were the larger of the states, they had more at stake. You see, what happened when they adopted the Constitution was they surrendered a great deal of their state's rights to the government or the centralized government. And for small states like Rhode Island and Delaware and some of those, it was not a real big deal at all, although I don't want to give you the impression that anybody just voted on it like that. There was argument in every state over the federal versus the anti-federal position. But not so keenly as was found in New York and in Virginia, because there was a great deal to lose in those states. Those were the two largest of states. And because of that, the issue was hotly contested back and forth and back and forth in those states. So two of the later states to ratify the Constitution were New York and Virginia. And to be honest with you, even though 9 states had ratified, there was not much hope that the Constitution would ever go anywhere until New York and Virginia ratified it. And that's basically how much power those two states had. The feeling was that all 11 all 11 other states could have ratified, and without those two states contained enough power economically, politically, to basically form their own country and be bigger than the other 11 states combined, or more powerful. And so it required, although it was unstated, it required basically the ratification by those two states. And it was not until there was an agreement made to amend the Constitution that it was ratified. There was a strange thing. The establishment stated that of the Constitution, it states in the Constitution that it can be ratified, or excuse me, can be amended by the states that have ratified it. In other words, we can change it. If we don't like it, we can go back, and if the states agree, we can make changes to this document. We can alter it. We can change things around. We can change wordings and times and dates. If we want to do that, if all of the states that get together can agree upon that, we can take care of that. And so before Virginia and New York would ratify that Constitution, there already had been a call to amend that Constitution. And of course, it was not amended once, but it was amended 10 times. There were 10 amendments made before the Constitution came into power. And those Ten Amendments are grouped together, and today they're called what? The Bill of Rights. Those were the Ten Amendments that were required. It's interesting to know, and what we'll look at for a few minutes this morning, is the fact that Isaac Backus, who was a Baptist preacher and evangelist, had, as they even begun, as a matter of fact, he did not live to see what we're talking about right now. But years before, Backus had stated that any government, in order to operate effectively, had to guarantee certain things to its people. And interestingly enough, the Bill of Rights is almost a carbon copy of what Backus said had to be guaranteed to people for a government to work. And I thought that was interesting. Since he was a Baptist, we achieved so many things of no, you know, ill favor, that we ought to at least pat ourselves on the back when we do something good. And so Isaac Backus, he never lived to see that day. He was dead long before that day occurred. But the Bill of Rights, the United States, if you look at what Backus wrote, is almost a carbon copy of what he said. He said, this is what a government, if a government is to long endure, if a government is to last, if it is to exist with the blessing of its people, these things have to be guaranteed. And that brings us to the point we want to cover this morning, and it is that of religious liberty and the First Amendment to our Constitution. What's the First Amendment to our Constitution state? Anybody know? Freedom of speech. All right. Somebody want to read it? Somebody want to tell me what it is? What's the Second Amendment to the Constitution say? All right. We got that one. Ah. What's the Third Amendment say? We're through, huh? We've got two of them. So it's no wonder people can take your rights away from us, right? We don't even know what they are. The First Amendment is the Freedom of Speech Amendment. Where's the Freedom of Religion Amendment? It's coupled with that one. The freedom, that's why they've had trouble attacking you, because the freedom of the press is coupled with that one. You start messing with the church, you're messing with the press. And that freedom of assembly, the freedom of the press, and freedom of religion are established together in there. And it makes it very tough. And then the next one gives you the right to keep and bear arms, which gives you the right to back the first one up. But as they began to formulate that thing, we look at what had happened, why that amendment had to be. And so this morning, briefly, we want to look at what the religious existence or the religious tide of this nation had been. We talked about, way back in the first session when we began, we talked about the fact that as the colonies were organized, what gave them the right to establish a colony? Anybody remember? I mean, did people just take a boat and come over here and build a house? Is that the way it worked? What was the legal authority that they had? It was what? I heard it was a charter. A charter that came from who? From England. Or whoever basically owned the land. Some of it was owned by Spain. Some of it was owned by France. But what we're dealing with was the English charters. And those charters were granted by the crown to specific individuals, or sometimes individuals or corporations. And those corporations or individuals came to this country and established a colony. And that charter was their rule. That was their grant to be here. And, of course, they were free to establish certain civil entities that could function as local governments. They were allowed to do that. But oftentimes, the charter established who the governor was to be. It established who was allowed to vote and who wasn't allowed to vote. It even went so far as to establish who could settle in the colony and who couldn't. Very restrictive in some cases. As a matter of fact, the Massachusetts Charter as well as the Virginia Charter, which were two of the largest charters granted by England, and that of course was the charter under which the Virginia colony was established, and also then the charter under which the Pilgrims came and established their government in Massachusetts. Both of those made specific statements regarding religion. And both of them stated that the Anglican Church was the state church. The Puritans and the Pilgrims came, basically paid no attention to it. But also stated something else. It stated that no Papist was permitted to settle in those territories. There's a lot of documents that are not preserved for posterity. They don't want anybody to see it. It's interesting, you can buy all these other documents. They won't propose a printing of a charter and let you see what those colonies were chartered under. They talk about, this country was founded upon religious liberty, religious liberty, religious liberty. I believe that. We're going to look at that. But you better learn to qualify religious liberty. To say religious liberty included every belief on the face of the earth is an absurdity. Because you have religious beliefs that are diametrically opposed one to another. I mean, for instance, if a man believed it was wrong to murder, and he said, we believe in religious liberty, and our religion teaches that it's wrong to murder, do you think that man believed for a minute that a man who believed it was right to murder had that same right? Americans don't think anymore. Americans just don't think. We say, what they wanted was a place where everybody from every faith, no matter what they believe, could... That's absurd. That's absurd. And you say, prove it. It doesn't need proving. I mean, you look at the diametrical opposition of a lot of religious beliefs, and it's obvious. It's obvious that they cannot get along. I mean, what if somebody believes in not going to war, and somebody believes in fighting and killing everybody? Somebody's got to give, somebody's got to lose some rights along that line. And because of that, we've had problems from the get-go. Because of differing opinions, but the nation has always stood upon one opinion. And that opinion basically, to be honest and absolute with you, was a Bible-based or a scriptural opinion. And as those charters were established, there was a denial of papists, the right to establish here. No Catholic was allowed to settle in America. And somebody said, why is that? Is that religious bigotry? We attach words, to make people hate things. See, you don't have to understand what it was all about. You just have to know all somebody has to do is get up there and say, it's religious bigotry. And immediately you hate what they stand for, even though you don't know what it is, because they told you, we attach hatred to those words. We say, oh, terrible. I heard a news commentator the other day. I thought, what a pro. They said somebody had been accused that there had been allegations of wrongdoing here, and I won't go into detail about what it was all about, but they said, we have examined thoroughly, and we can find no substantiation to such charges yet. Well, what's that telling you? Yeah, what they're telling you is, we know it's there, we just can't find it yet. So immediately you come out thinking, that guy's dirty, they just haven't been able to find it yet. And I thought about several months ago when a higher official in our country was involved in some allegations of wrongdoing, and they said, we can't find anything that he's done. The man must be innocent. So it's the way you portray the facts, you see. You can either say, we can't find anything, so he must be innocent. Or you say, we haven't found anything yet. You see how it's done? And we don't want to portray these documents. We don't want these documents to be presented to the American people. We don't want the American people to know what their freedom's based on. Those charters denied Catholics the right to settle in America. Now, you say, are you anti-Catholic? No. I'm not anti-Catholic. But I think that my children have a right to know this nation at one time was very anti-Catholic. I think my children need to know that. You say, why? I believe in them learning their heritage. You say, I don't want my children to know that because they might grow up to hate people. Yeah, but they might grow up to be stupid too. I mean, do we want them to learn history or don't we? And the thing is, not that because these people here were anti-Catholic, we should be anti-Catholic. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying if our forefathers were anti-Catholic in their approach, don't you think we ought to know why? Why were they opposed to the papacy? What was going on? Maybe my kids don't need to know we were anti-Catholic, but maybe they need to know that our forefathers had a reason to be suspicious of the papacy. And of course, we went through that in the first series, and we'll not go through it at this time in length, but the Reformation had just taken place in England about a century before. People were dying over there by the hundreds as the papacy tried to stranglehold all of Europe and impose itself not only in religious matters, but in civil matters. And the papacy had basically gained control. If you don't believe that, go to Europe today. They still have control. You want privileges in certain countries like Italy. Brother Eccles is going to Italy. You look at some of those conditions there. You can lose your job if you leave the Catholic Church. You can lose the home that you live in if you leave the Catholic Church. And over there, what's funny is most people despise the Catholic Church. You say, how can that be? Kind of like we despise government. Right? We get together in our little conclaves. We say, boy, taxes. I hate taxes. Them guys are crooks getting our money in. But you pay them, don't you? Amen. Every April the 15th, you send a check into Uncle Sam. Say, here it is. It's what I owe you. And the same thing exists religiously throughout Europe. But the hold is there. It's even stronger in Central and South America. I mentioned the fact that if you wanted to run for the president of the country of Mexico under Constitution, you cannot be elected president of Mexico unless you are a member of the Roman Catholic Church. It's amazing, while people run around talking about human rights, human rights, human rights, and we talk about religious rights, nobody else in the world believes what we believe as far as religious rights are concerned. Why is America so strange when it comes to religious rights? Well, it didn't start out that way. The charters were very rigid religious liberties. They established the Anglican Church. And of course, as we said before, in the case of the Puritans, they came in rebellion to that, and basically they established their own colony free and independent of their charter. But the Anglican way of life, even though the Puritans were opposed to the Anglican operation, they didn't have anything else. And so as they established their own religious ideals, a lot of them match the Anglican system. And while they didn't agree with what the Anglican Church taught, as far as the hierarchy of their church, the Puritans were as restrictive on their people as the Anglicans were. As far as their imposing themselves in methods of taxation and other things, they were as restrictive as others. But the American colonists, as they established here, the crown of England did not want the papacy to gain hold in the United States or in the colonies. Why? Because the crown was basically the only Protestant entity in all of Europe, maybe with the exception of Switzerland, and Switzerland was being butchered. And those two countries to this day still have a Protestant heritage. Everything else over there is Roman Catholic heritage. England didn't want that to be established in the colonies, so they took steps to ensure that it could not happen. No papists were allowed. Now then, as they established, though, these colony charters established religion. Most of the time, the governor was either the head of a church, or the church leader was the head of the government, or there was some close tie between them, because religion and government went together. As a matter of fact, I made a list this morning. I stated that in Massachusetts and Connecticut, their laws were rigid in the fact that if you did not belong to the religious organization found in their charter, you were expelled from the colony. That's why we talked about Williams being sent out from the Massachusetts colony. We talked about Williams was a little wacky, I understand. He had some ideas that, basically nobody had. But he was thrown out of the Puritans and of the Pilgrims colonies. They said, get out, we don't want you here. If you're not going to adhere to what our religious dictates state, then you have to leave. You have to go and leave this colony. You can't live here. Massachusetts and Connecticut, very restrictive. And other states had a basic element of freedom. Delaware and New Jersey basically were a little less restrictive than other areas. They allowed for several different churches to exist simultaneously, but not nearly what we have today. New York, North and South Carolina, and Georgia all imposed Anglicanism. Church of England, you had to be a member of the Anglican Church in order to exist in those communities. Now, this is what I mean. Those colonies did not necessarily throw you out if you were not an Anglican. However, you could not, I've got a list here, you could not vote. Voting privileges extended to those who were members of the church. You could not vote. You had to compulsory, you were made to attend those churches. Compulsory attendance. I'd kind of like that one myself. I, you know, I think it'd be a great law. You have to go to church. But I'm kidding, all right? There's compulsory attendance mandated. The civil government or the civil matters were governed over by the church heads and the rulers of the church. In other words, if you had a problem here with your water bill, you'd come to the preacher. And he'd have to dictate that thing for you. He was in charge of those things. And that's what came about. Not only that, but there were taxes levied. You see, again, even in the colonies where Anglicanism wasn't the way of life, they adopted an Anglican system, which was this. Americans don't know anything about this because we're Americans. You know, we're so smart, we're stupid. And in other churches, in other countries, when you're born, you pay taxes just like you do in America. However, in other countries, a percentage of that tax goes to the church, the state church. That's what the meaning is of a state church. Roman Catholicism is the state church of Italy. It is the state church of Germany. It is the state church of Spain. It is the state church of France. It is the state church of Portugal. And in those countries, an element of every tax dollar collected goes in return back to the church. And in England has a state church. And part of every tax dollar collected goes back to the Anglican church. You say, what do they do with it? They pay their preachers. Their preachers there are state employees. They're state employees. They're paid by the state. As a matter of fact, in England, if you'll see some of the slides that our missionaries in England and Scotland have brought back, how many of you remember the pictures of the churches that have been turned into car washes and things like that? And then they'd show you pictures of churches and they'd say, you know, here's this huge cathedral, 10 times the size of this building you're in this morning, where only 20 people meet. Did you ever wonder who pays the heat and the light bill? It's the English people. The English people pay to light and to heat and to pump water in and sewage out of that huge building. Why? Because it's an English landmark. See, the civil government takes care of it. And your tax dollars at work, you know, you can put out in front of those churches. And so that's what happens in a state system. You pay tax dollars. And now, let me ask you a question. How many of you would like to pay tax dollars this morning to the Presbyterian Church, to pay the Presbyterian preacher? So you wouldn't like that at all, I would hope. You wouldn't like paying tax dollars to support the Pentecostal light bill down the street for the Pentecostal church. We wouldn't appreciate having to pay tax dollars to take care of the Roman Catholic Church buying a new bell to go in the belfry. Why? Because we're Americans. But in every other nation, or I say every other, that's not 100%, but in most other nations, that's exactly the way the system is set up. Only your tax dollars aren't divided among all the different churches, such as the Presbyterian or the Pentecostals or the Catholics. In those states, there is a state church. And that state church receives funds, and no other churches can exist legally, or else if they do, they cannot have state funds. In Greece, Brother Bailey's not here this morning. His family's out on the road, I suppose. But in Greece, it is the Greek Orthodox Church. And when you are born, you are by birth, you're a member of the Greek Orthodox Church. You're going to pay taxes. You're a Greek citizen, and Greek citizens are Greek Orthodox. Now, you can go into Greece as another religious denomination, but you are not free to establish a church. You're not free to proselytize. Brother Bailey has done an excellent job. If you had a chance to go and see that work there that he and Brother Ford have, it's uncanny. It's uncanny. In the city of Athens, where there are 4.5 million people. Now, how many of you have been to New York or Chicago? How many of you have been to Chicago? I guess Chicago is probably 4 million people, isn't it? Maybe not quite that many, but it's probably right. I think New York is around 12 million. 4.5 million people in the city of Athens, there is one Greek Baptist preacher, Brother Boussios. One. And I was in his church, preached in his church. He runs about 35 people. One. And Brother Bailey has a work. You say, how did Brother Bailey get started? Brother Bailey started by not reaching the Greek people. That's the best way to do it. You say, why? You'd be put in jail or deported for trying to change the religious affiliation of people. Now, you've got in this new hate crime legislation in America, you've got several statements in there that could be taken the same way. In other words, if you were born a Roman Catholic and I try to get you to come to a Baptist church, or if I witness to you, I could be found guilty of a hate crime in America. Now, that's dangerous. Dangerous. Now, I'm not saying this, it doesn't state that specifically. But you see, the interpretation of the laws is up to the courts, not you and I. And we just found with Proposal 187 in California, it doesn't make any difference what the majority of the people say in this country anymore. It's the Supreme Court that runs this country. And if everybody in this country voted overnight, if it was a unanimous decision, it could be overturned in a court system. Thomas Jefferson stated, almost, I'll give you this quote almost verbatim, he said, the federal judiciary will be the undoing of this union. He said it should not be entrusted to judges to determine what the Constitution says, but the people. I got that quote in there in my office. Now then, what were we talking about? We were talking about Brother Bailey establishing a church, which has nothing to do with American history, but it's more interesting than American history. At this point, when you hit a lull, you go off to something else, okay? We'll be back on this in a minute. Brother Bailey began to reach other nationalities in Greece. He began to go after other nations. Why? Because they're not members of the Greek Orthodox Church. Many times they're there on work visas or they're there to go to college. And he began, as an American, you've got a real interesting opportunity anywhere in the world because you speak English. If you Americans would learn another language, you would have an opportunity to go into many, many countries uncontested with the gospel because you can teach English. Brother Grabke, I think, told me his oldest son, who's not here at this point, is married and gone away, is fixing to be able to go into the country of Australia or Greece, and they're going to pay for his home, they're going to pay for his move, because he can go there and teach English. Well, you know, if you're a Christian, you're being invited with open arms to come and teach English in a great portion of this world. Why? Because English is going to be the national language, or the universal language. It's already been determined. Brother Bailey began to hold services in English. You put a little ad in the paper, say, such and such Baptist church, services in English. Well, what would you think somebody that's going to the University of Athens trying to learn English would want to do? You'd want to speak it. You want to hear it spoken. So they would come out of curiosity to hear and as a result of hearing the gospel, they'd get saved. And now the Greek families have started to get... Why? Because these people, a lot of these people are from the Philippines. There were people in the church there from Sri Lanka and from Lebanon and from Egypt and all over the place. I met people from more countries in the world in that one service than I met in my whole lifetime, I guess. But those people, a lot of them, as they're going to school, they work day jobs or night jobs cleaning houses of influential Greek people, working as babysitters for Greek families, working in little shops that have Greek owners. And now as a result of those people getting saved, the Greeks are starting to get saved. Brother Ford and Brother Bailey, I believe, baptized, 11 people when they went back? Just this last 2 weeks ago, baptized 11, and the majority of them were Greek people? But that's the way things work. Why? Because you're under a system that's established as a state church system. Much more difficult to establish in a church there. It can be done, but not the way it's done in America. And so, these colonies existed with a state church set up. And then the colonies went to war against England. Remember in the Declaration of Independence as we came through there, one of the real blows, actually the straw that broke the camel's back, was the statement by the King of England that did what? You remember to the Quebec Act? The Quebec Act gave basically one-third of the American territory to the Quebec colony and recognize Roman Catholicism as the only viable religion for that land area. It extended the Quebec colony southward to the Ohio River to the borders of the Allegheny Mountains all the way over to the Mississippi River. It gave them that big chunk that you and I live in right now, and stated that Catholicism was accepted as the only religion, and that's what ticked the colonists off. And you can find a reference to that in the Declaration of Independence. We talked about it. They specifically made statement regarding the Quebec Act as no more. We're not going to take it anymore. And as we went into the time of the Revolution, the clergymen got involved. We talked about the Black Regiment. The Black Regiment was the English name for a bunch of preachers that got their congregations organized and went to fight. They would have services on Sunday morning, dismiss, have a meal, a kind of a dinner on the grounds deal, and then they would drill. I started saying the parking lot, but I guess they didn't have parking lots. They would drill in the churchyard. They would march and go through their regimentation. They would learn to use their bayonets and their muskets, and then they'd come back and have church service. And the clergymen were the outspoken pushers of the revolution. They were the ones that encouraged the people. They were the ones that... And so really, to be honest with you, now that this country has been birthed, and these men are trying to establish a national government, you could either see the clergyman as an ally or a foe, but nowhere in between. They recognize the power of the clergy. To be honest with you, I'll just make a statement this morning. I believe I could wield more power as a preacher than any congressman in this country. If you don't believe that, you look at Jim Jones, you look at Koresh, you look at some of these guys, you look at this National Catholic Council of Catholic Laymen, the Bishop's Council, and you look when they release a statement, how far it goes. There's power in the pulpit. Now, that power ought to be God's power. It ought to be God-given power. But even if it isn't, there's still power in the pulpit. And as these individuals get together and they begin to decide what they're going to do with their new nation, historically, they would establish a state church. That's what they've got to draw from. Or they could establish absolutely no religion because of the damage that could be imposed upon this national government by the clergymen. Outside of the forces of the politicians like Washington and Adams and Jefferson, the men that wielded the greatest amount of power in this country just after the Revolutionary War were clergymen. You see, a clergyman spoke for God. And when a clergyman said, this is wrong, his people didn't just go home and say, well, you know, that preacher, he just got all kind of strange opinions. They went home and said, hey, that's it. Preacher said it's wrong. We're not going to do it. Could be a real ally. Could be a real foe. And so when they began to establish this constitution, they had to contend with that. What are we going to do with religion? All the way back from the beginning of taxation, there was a group of people that opposed religious or ecclesiastical taxes. You see, those taxes were used to pay the preacher's salary, to keep the building up, and even the Puritans, the Pilgrims, all of those individuals knew what it was to be taxed, religious tax. One group in this country, if you trace their history, suffered more for their opposition to the ecclesiastical taxes than any other group. And in case you wonder, I'm always bad-mouthing the Baptists. And I have a right to, because I'm a Baptist. But sometimes people come to me and say, you know, if you feel the way you feel about all these crazy Baptists, why are you still a Baptist? Because of my heritage. I am not a Baptist today because of what the Baptists are. I am a Baptist today because of what the Baptists were. The Baptist is the only religious denomination to know persecution in the United States of America. They were persecuted for what they believed. What did they believe? They didn't believe in paying ecclesiastical taxes. They were opposed to it. And when the colony at Rhode Island was established, you remember there, the wacko went over and established the colony, and he was a little crazy. But one of the things he established was the fact that we believe in religious liberty. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean today the same thing it meant then. What it meant then was, we believe, liberty. What is liberty? It's freedom. Freedom from what? Freedom to what? Religious liberty, employed by the founder of the Rhode Island colony, believed that you were free to think anything you wanted to think. Freedom of conscience. You had that freedom. And you were free from any taxation to pay for somebody else's opposing viewpoint. And the idea was this: if you don't like what that church believes, you don't have to pay money to it. If you don't like what they believe, listen, they've got a freedom to believe what they want to believe. They've got a right to believe what they want to believe. But if you don't agree with it, you don't have to pay your money to that church. You say, where'd that come from? That's a Baptist belief. And that's why this nation exists with a religious environment, because the Baptists believe that. The Catholics didn't believe that. The Anglicans didn't believe that. The Methodists didn't believe that. The Presbyterians didn't believe that. But the Baptists did. Now, how does it work in America today? There's a Presbyterian church down the street. We don't like what they teach. So what do? We don't have to pay them any money. You say, where did that come from? That came from Baptists. That's why I'm a Baptist. What we were. I don't agree with what we are. I think we're a bunch of Bible-rejecting fanatics and heathen right now, as far as a Baptist denomination. But we were people that stood up for what was right. And the Baptists were persecuted for it. They were thrown out of one colony after another. They were expelled from one colony after another because they wouldn't pay religious taxes. And as early as the Continental Congress of 1774, before the Revolution ever began, when all the talk was being made about political freedom and we're free from England and we don't have to listen to what England says, the Baptists were petitioning those same politicians about, hey, if you believe we don't have to believe what England believes politically, why do you still maintain that religiously we have to believe what you believe? Where is religious freedom? And the Continental Congress of 1774 refused to address the issue. The case in point was Massachusetts. Massachusetts was one of the forerunners for maintaining political freedom. We don't have to think what England thinks. We don't have to be the kind of country England is. And when they met for that constitution, Bacchus and some of these other individuals gathered together, and the Quakers. The Quakers, really, to be honest with you, were our counterpart in the persecution. The Baptists and the Quakers, we've heard. They confronted the delegates to that convention and they said, what about religious freedom? And they refused to address it. Now we've come through a war. Now we are at the point in time where we are looking at developing a document that will govern our country. The supreme law of the land. That's what the Constitution is. And when it went for ratification back to the states had begun to learn how decadent a church system could become. You see, while they knew enough to not want the papacy in America, they were naive enough at the beginning to believe that the Anglican system was all right. But we taught you when we first started, the Anglican system basically was Roman Catholicism with a new garb. And now all these men, as they gather, they've gained some experience and they've begun to see that even the Anglican system is not so hot. And so what do you turn to? And it was the Baptists that helped establish the statement in your Constitution that said Congress shall make no law prohibiting an establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof, the right to assemble, and the freedom of speech. All of those things incorporate. Why? Because we knew this nation had to have something different than all the other nations round about it. What does religious liberty mean? America today has become a very multicultural society. See, listen, you can tell you're being programmed. You want me to give you proof you're being programmed? We don't even realize. Oh, it doesn't bother. When I say multicultural, you get this flowery in your mind? When I say religious bigotry, You notice what happens inside of you? Listen, those are not natural reactions. Those have been programmed into you. You say, where? TV, radio, newspapers. You hear a word used in a derogatory form long enough and you begin to believe it as a derogatory word. You see, that's the way it's done. And we have come to a place of multiculturalism where we have used our own laws to hang ourselves. For instance, we now believe that secular humanism is a viable religion and is freedom from taxation, free to teach. And you know, the people that have the control at this point are the people that are opposed to what you and I believe. And they're using the freedom of religion clause to protect themselves. And they're saying, wait a minute, don't you believe in religious freedom? And we say, yeah,
we believe in that.
And they say, well, don't you believe we should have freedom? No. I don't believe freedom of religion is for everybody. I believe freedom of religion was free to protect the religious system that was in place when this country was founded. And not one colony that existed was an unchristian colony. Now, we can use another term, Judeo-Christian. See, we've been made to hate that. Listen, there was no Muslim colonies in America. You say, well, don't you believe Muslim people? I believe they got a right to worship in America. They got a right to build temples. I don't believe the taxation covers them. I don't believe that any of those things cover them. You say, well, you don't believe in freedom. Sure, I do. But I don't believe that I need to extend that freedom to people that have my end in mind. See, we believe, you say, what are you talking about? You read the writings of the Quran, you read the writings of Muhammad, and Muhammadan's desire was to kill every Protestant and every Jew. That's when he died, from some of his last statements. Was that the Muslim faith would never be victorious until all the Christians and all the Jews were dead. How many people believe that? How many people believe we'll give those people tax exemption? Not only that, but through this multiculturalism, we're funding their religious movements. You say, what's going on? Something's changed in our Constitution. Something's changed in our Constitution. Now, we're going to look next week more at this amendment and what they were saying. Not my interpretation of what they were saying, but what they were saying. The statement that says Congress shall make no law establishing an establishment. Congress shall make no law. Help me here. My mind is a complete blank. Respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That is not the first draft. That's the one that was finally agreed upon. There were about 12 that preceded that. And all 12 of them state the same thing. And we'll look at what that is. What were they trying to say? They couldn't get the wording right, but what were they trying to say?